Hello everyone, welcome to a brand new episode of Gibology, a podcast about the Bee Gees. I'm your host, Sarah, and it has been approximately 150 years since the last episode of the podcast. Apologies for the very long break, but I have a great reason to be back now because I am joined by two guests who have been on the podcast previously. Andrew Munn-Hughes and Grant Walters, two of the authors of Decades, the Bee Gees in the 1970s. The third author, of course, is Mark Crowan, but he was unfortunately unable to join us for this episode. I previously spoke to the guys about the first volume in the series on the 1960s, so you can go back and find that on your favourite podcast platform, and I would highly recommend giving that a listen before you dive into this episode, especially if you haven't read the book on the 1970s yet. But it is an absolutely fantastic read, as expected, and we have so much to cover, so much in fact that I've split this conversation into two podcasts. So you'll be able to hear all about the second part of the 1970s in part two. But for now, here is part one, where we get talking about the writing process and just how the early 70s went for the Bee Gees when they got back together post-split. Enjoy. So it's been a good while since my last episode of the podcast. Apologies for that. I'll try and get back on track, but I am delighted to be joined by two of the three authors of Decades, the Bee Gees in the 1970s, Andrew and Grant. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Oh, good morning. Thanks.
Good to be here again, Sarah. Good to be here again. Yes, apologies for Mark. His time machine mouth malfunctioned and he's not available today.
That's no problem. So I think it was the end of 2021 when you were last on the podcast when the 1960s volume was released. So assuming that most people who are listening to this have read that book, and if not, then they might want to switch off now and read that before starting this one. But what was the writing and editing process like for this book? Like, was there anything different in the way that you approached it compared to the last time?
From a writing perspective, things didn't change at all, really. It's useful being in three different time zones, because what we do is we upload the work document to Dropbox. When Mark's in bed, it's a time when either Grant or I can work on it. And when Grant's in bed, Mark can work on things. So that's okay. We kind of figured it seemed to work well for the previous volume. So, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know?
We really struggled with editing this book this time around. And we were talking offline before this a little bit about it. But the publisher, I mean, to their credit, wanted to get somebody who had some musical expertise to look at our book and, you know, sort of as a whole entity and sort of look at the integrity of it and made sure that everything sort of matched and that we were using, you know, correct terminology. And so they thought that might be useful. I wish that had turned out better. So our editor went through and changed major chunks of our copy, and did a lot of things where they were questioning some of the actual things that happened during the Bee Gees' career because of their opinion, those things shouldn't have happened. Clearly he didn't know them or wasn't really familiar with their work, but you know, the Bee Gees were innovators. And so, you know, one example was that when we wrote about the drum loop that Albie Gallatin and Carl Richardson had invented for Stayin' Alive, because Dennis Bryan had to be absent because of a family member taking ill. You know, he said he crossed it out and deleted that passage and said, well, that couldn't have happened because drum loops weren't invented yet. And so he changed the whole thing and took it out. And we said, well, silly, like they invented that on the spot. And so, you know, that's a well-documented event, you know, pretty well known, not just to fans, but also throughout the music industry. Yeah. I mean, Carl and Albie were musical innovators. So there was just something like that. You know, we bumped into some other things too. He did offer some helpful things like terminology, like, you know, when we said, oh, this sounds like a keyboard, he would say, actually, that's a clavinet. okay, well, that's really helpful, right? So those sort of technical corrections, you know, serve the purpose really well. You know, the other thing that he corrected that I was, my favorite thing that I think he did was that we were talking about Here at Last, Bee Gees Live, and how during the actual, the raw recording of the concert, Barry sounded raspy because it was the end of a tour. And he'd been singing in falsetto for months at that point in time. And so when they took it back into the studio to, you know, to clean it up a little bit, they dubbed in some new vocal on top of the live one. Very common practice. You know, I talked about the fact that Barry's voice was exhausted, and, you know, his commentary was, he said, well, that's ridiculous. How hard is it to sing in falsetto? And I was like, clearly you don't understand the magnitude to which Barry sang in falsetto, and, you know, the precision and the volume with which he sang, and, you know, the intensity. And so it was, there were just things like that that really didn't help us out. And so, but he did a lot of, he did a lot of things with punctuation that weren't correct either. And so we had to go back and change a lot of those things. So it was exhausting, and it was really frustrating. So we came out of that really a little bit downtrodden, to be honest with you. And so, so that was a major challenge.
Yeah. We lost months on this. Yeah. And if you'd pre-ordered your book on Amazon, for instance, lots of you would have seen the publication date going back and back and back, you know, like it was extremely frustrating. And having to actually write up what needed correcting. It was so demoralizing, lots of, because it was written and it was right. And he was changing things, lots of contractions, lots of, for instance, would have, could have, you know. We don't put that into our narrative. If it's part of a quote from somebody, yes, we will leave it in, but not as something that we actually write. Extremely frustrating that we lost so much time on it. So we're kind of taking a little bit of a break right now from writing, as we're concentrating more on promo. Mm-hmm. Like sort of, you know, so instead of diving straight into the 1980s, we really needed a break after that. The work documents are pretty much there. Like sort of, you know, done a lot of research. So when anybody feels like piling in and doing some work on it, like sort of, it's there and it's ready, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying a while ago before we started recording, reading the book, it was really, you know, obvious how much time and effort and work went into it. And also just the fact that, you know, the 1970s was like, they packed so much into that decade, so much different stuff, so many changes in their sound. And yeah, you can just, I mean, obviously a lot of work would have gone into the 60s volume as well, but they just did so much more throughout the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And while in the 80s they didn't have much product coming out under the Bee Gees banner, there was so many different other production works that they did, the solo albums, the movie soundtracks that Morris worked on and stuff like that. So like I said, this could be quite an expansive work as well.
So I just wanted to comment on Spencer Gibbs' foreword. Obviously, he did one for the first book as well. Yeah, I just loved it. I thought it was fascinating, his approach to that. He provided a lot of good insight into the American music scene and just everything that was happening culturally there in the 1970s. Were you pleased with that?
I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. He explained disco, which is a word that I'm always reluctant to use when I talk about the Bee Gees. But Spencer explained what disco was in a manner that I've never heard it explained before. And the way that he also explained the reasoning, let's say, behind the backlash, let's say, was absolutely fascinating. It's an absolutely brilliant forward.
Yeah, Spencer, you know, so Spencer and I have gotten to know each other pretty well over the past few years. And so, you know, as he was working on this, I kept getting, you know, messages about, he's like, I'm revising it again. And so he wrote it probably 5 or 6 times over and over again. And so, I mean, he really wanted to make it, perfect. And so, he did, I mean, he did a phenomenal job. You know, he has an innate sense of the industry, but also Spencer's incredibly smart. So, I mean, he's a student of a lot of different you know, researchers and authors and things like that. So, I mean, his ability to be in tune with things that are happening socially. So, I mean, this was the perfect sort of mix of that. And I think he really, really explained the interplay between, you know, what was happening, you know, in terms musically with Saturday Night Fever and everything associated with it, and then what was happening in the background socially in America. You know, a lot of people forget that Spencer has lived in America most of his life. And so, you know, he's Robin Gibb's son for sure, but, you know, and certainly has a British sense of humor and things like that. But he, you know, he has his ear to the ground here and has been seeing that since he was a little boy. So, you know, I think he really captured a lot of really important things. Some fans have balked at it, actually. And I think, you know, we've gotten some comments in different forums about how, you know, well, why do you need to tie this to politics? And well, you know, the Bee Gees were not apolitical, unfortunately. Music never is. And so music is a reflection of society. You know, Stayin' Alive was written about the turmoil that was happening on the streets of New York City, you know, in the late 70s and things like that as well. New York is a much different place now than it was in 1976 and 1977 in lots of different ways. But, you know, so the disco era happened because of what was happening behind the scenes. And we'll talk about Saturday Night Fever a little bit later on, but, and sort of the background of that, but, yeah, there was a lot of stuff happening socially, politically, economically, that fueled the disco era and then caused its downfall as well. And it's not unlike what's happening right now in America either. And so there are some really distinct similarities between what happened at the end of the 1970s and what's happening in 2023 here. And so that was Spencer keyed into that and I think did a really nice job of showing those parallels.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been quite easy for him to just focus on his family connection and that side of it. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a great approach that he took. And, you know, just obviously he's a great musician and everything himself, but he's such a great writer as well, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And from our point of view, it's really important that we've had his endorsement on these books. That's really important. It's very, very flattering as well. You know, that he was saying that these are books that needed to be written.
Yeah.
And some of the goodies you see in the text are, you know, partially because of him and just cluing us into some, not always explicitly. And you know, we don't obviously refer to him throughout the book, but some of the little Easter eggs that people see in the book that they may not have seen before. You know, Spencer was really, you know, kind to help us out with some of those things and giving us a bit of context that we might not have had otherwise. So he does show up in the copy, even if he's not named.
So I suppose, going back to the beginning of the decade, they were coming back together, having split at the end of the 60s. And well, the first Bee Gees album of the 70s was Cucumber Castle, which was just Barry and Morris. And there's a lot of good songs on that album, despite Robin's absence. But do you think the fact that the release was delayed for so long, did that harm the success of the album, I suppose?
I don't really think that the time frame between Don't Forget to Remember, which was August 1969, and the actual release of the album, which was April 1970. I think it was more what was happening with the brothers, because at the time of the release of the album, the Bee Gees didn't actually exist. It had totally disintegrated. Barry quit, you know, tail end of 1969, leaving poor old Morris to fend for himself. They effectively became, you know, solo artists. And, you know, we have the proof there that is what happened. Barry started getting into production work with P.P. Arnold. And he didn't really kind of get into doing his solo material particularly quickly, whereas Morris joined up with his brother-in-law Billy Laurie, and he really got into things very, very quickly and became very, very productive between one thing and another. When product actually did come out prior to the release of the album as well, I don't think they put the right single out in the US. They put out If Only I Had My Mind on Something Else, which really didn't resonate there. And the month after, they put out Ayaya, which, although a better single, still wasn't a hit, you know, which is a shame, because it was a good song. The Bee Gees, as I say, they just didn't exist at that point. So I don't know what they would have done to promote the album or anything. It was just a strange kind of time, a really strange time.
It was a really ugly period for them. And, you know, looking back on some of the press clippings and, you know, some of the video footage from different shows and things like that. I mean, it was pretty, pretty acidic, if you will. And so, you know, I think that, as Andrew mentioned, you know, the public got wind of that, and it took them a long time to recover from that, not just internally, but I think in the eyes of the public. And so when they eventually came back, I think people still had a little bit of a bitter taste in their mouths, the U.S. less so, because they weren't fighting as much in the U.S. press, or there wasn't as much coverage. But yeah, in the U.K., it was pretty intense.
Yeah, it was kind of, I was surprised to hear that, you know, they didn't actually play in concert in the UK until 1973. And it took, what, 4 years after the reunion for their first UK tour. So what do you think the reasons were for that, sort of the fact that the UK was slow to kind of embrace them again? Was it the fact that they'd been in the press fighting with each other all that time and it just put people off?
Yeah, the British public, lots of, seem pretty unforgiving. Although the change in the sound on 2 Years On and Trafalgar, the most commercial tracks there, seem to be more focused on the US rather than the UK, which I think was absolutely right. Because, you know, Lonely Days, when we talk Billboard, we're talking number three, Cashbox number one, didn't do a damn thing over here. And How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, first number one in the US on Billboard. In the UK, that one did even less than Lonely Days. So the songs that did resonate over here were a couple of years later. So we had My World in January 72, followed by Run to Me in June. So they were still kind of there. And they were still touring in, you know, the US, Japan, Australia, lots of them, and touring very, very successfully on the back of all of that. Their first performance in the UK was February 1973, and that was at the Royal Festival Hall in London. It was about 2 weeks prior to the launch of RSO Records as a label. And the first album to be released on 1st of March was Life in a Tin Can. It was the first concert that they actually performed in the UK since the legendary Talk of the Town gig, where, again, this was during the split. And to make up the numbers, Barry and Morris brought in Sister Leslie, to make up the three-part harmony. There were plans to record this concert, and that actually never came to fruition. What was happening was, because at this point we know that the Bee Gees had two albums ready to release here. The first, obviously, as I just mentioned, is Life in a Tin Can, and then strangely, 4 months later, in July, that was the intended release date of A Kick in the Head Is Worth Eight in the Pants. And I think the decision was taken not to release that album because Tin Can wasn't a great success. So you don't want to really follow a flop so soon.
Yeah, so it's really the mid-70s when things kind of begin to stagnate for them. Obviously, they have an album rejected by their label, which we just mentioned, and they end up having to play clubs in the north of England. And you highlighted in the book the fact that they were really struggling to keep up with the musical trends of the time. They didn't seem to know who their audience was or what kind of band they wanted to be. How would you rate the music that they were putting out during this period? And do you think it's better than maybe they were given credit for?
It's actually one of my favorite periods, between 70 and 74. Mr. Natural being a particular favorite. The styles that they were pumping out were so diverse. You could see, like, to do with 2 years on, you could see and hear more clearly who was involved in the writing process with things. It's, in a way, it's very similar to This Is Where I Came In, where you can tell, yeah, that's definitely Robin. Yeah, that's definitely Barry, you know. I think it actually worked better as an album than This Is Where I Came In. It did tend to gel a little bit better. Trafalgar, lots of it went all out on orchestra. It was just so overblown. Like, sort of, I just can't help not love it. Probably the most diverse album they've ever made, is To Whom It May Concern. And as Morris explained, why did you call it that? And he said, like, sort of, well, like, sort of, we're just trying to actually figure out, like, sort of, who is actually interested in our music and who our audience is. Tin Can, I think that was a brave move. Because it took them out of familiar surroundings of the recording studios in London, and they were working with session musicians, you know, Jim Keltner, Sneaky Pete, Jane Getz, Rick Gresh, people like that, and a totally new studio crew, Mike Stone producing and stuff like that. So they were working with people that they weren't actually used to working with. And another big difference there was the arranger, Johnny Pate. He came in as the arranger on these albums, on that album. It sounded as if they were kind of more aiming towards an American audience with that album. You know, there's a bit more kind of country in there. I enjoy the album, as I say, but I think not being in familiar surroundings really kind of threw them. Where are we? 73, 74. So Mr. Natural, that brought them back to the UK. So they recorded it at IBC and at Command. They also recorded some of it in New York, but it was at Atlantic Studios, which they were already familiar with because they recorded some stuff for Odessa there as well. And bringing in Arif Mardin as the producer on this album, that was just an absolute masterstroke. It's a transitional album, but so was Main Course. And I don't feel that the transition was complete until Children of the World, really, where they lost external producers and started producing themselves, although in conjunction with Carl Richards and Albie Gallutin. So, yeah, I think the material was really, really good. It just wasn't accepted over here in the UK. Strangely, in early 72, they went over to Italy and played a couple of gigs over there, did a lot of television promo and stuff like that. And subsequently, they were having good success with singles over there. There were big top 10 hits over there. But only Italy. They didn't go and do any other gigs anywhere else in Europe. So that just seems strange. They probably had an invitation to do a little bit of promo on TV and thought, well, while we're over there, we might as well be earning some money and, you know, throw in a couple of gigs over there.
The 70-74 period was not one of my favorites, but I think Andrew and Mark have a much more, much greater affection for it. I think there are some really great gems, but, you know, it's no secret that I love the 75-79 period a little bit more. And I don't think the music was bad at all. I think, you know, they struck a chord in America. You know, something happened between British and U.S. music at the end of 1969 into 1970. There was sort of this diversion. And America, I think, you know, they were reeling from what had happened in the 1960s. There was so much. It was a really tumultuous decade, especially towards the end, you know, politically and socially. And so Americans got very introspective, and so did the music for a period of time. And so, you know, when you release songs like Lonely Bays and Broken Hearts, you know, that was, you know, completely fitting for an American audience at that point in time. So I think that did really, really well in America and synced really well with the time. So the Bee Gees were sort of right there not as much so in the UK. And How Can You Mend a Broken Heart wasn't just a hit. It was a huge hit. It was, you know, it was at number one for 4 weeks here. And so it was a major, major smash for that year. It was one of the top singles of the year. So, you know, but after Run to Me and My World, Run to Me, I think, was a top 20 hit here. And so was My World. I think they were both number 16, something like that. After that, everybody lost interest in what they were doing, at least from a public perspective anyway. You know, they came to the United States, to Los Angeles, and they recorded Life in a Tin Can. You know, you would think that maybe if they were trying to focus on an American audience, they would have, you know, sort of taking advantage of the whole, you know, sort of really sun-kissed California sound that was coming out at the time. And I'm thinking of, you know, the Doobie Brothers, the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt, America, Little Feet, you know, those bands that were really, there was some folksy music, but it was also starting to infuse some of that R&B stuff that would evolve into, you know, what came out later in the decade. And the Bee Gees just didn't take advantage of any of it. And so, you know, you have an album that was recorded in California that sounded like it could have been recorded on a damp street in Britain, right? And so I think that they may have misjudged that a little bit. So I don't think Life in a Tin Can really did well in the US either, because it just wasn't, it didn't move with the times a little bit. And perhaps they wanted to shift gears. And maybe that's why they recruited, you know, so many of those session players and producers. I think they wanted to make a change, but maybe they just didn't have the confidence and the know-how. Robert Stigwood certainly saw that they were, you know, sort of stuck in a rut, and it took him a little while to kind of respond as well. But, you know, as Andrew mentioned, Arif Mardin helped to course correct that. So starting with Mr. Natural, I mean, you could hear the change in their confidence and what they were willing to do. You know, and the thing about the 70s, the Bee Gees won't talk about that period very much at all. Barry has never, it's one of the things that I think really railroaded the reissue program that happened a few years ago. Once they got to Odessa, I think Barry, we don't want to talk about that period anymore. And so they would have had to go through years of reissues until they finally got the main course, where he would have felt that that was, you know, successful. They only wanted to talk about things that were hits. And that's a big problem, because, you know, they were really successful throughout their career, but they had a lot of periods where, at least commercially, they, you know, weren't always at the top of their game. And so that was challenging. So they really haven't talked about that period very much since at all. But, you know, they were only really down for 2 years, you know, so the time between Run to Me and My World and when Jive Talking came out, I mean, it was a relatively short period of time. In 2023, that would be like nothing. An artist would come back and they'd be like, oh yeah, right, by the way, yeah, just put out a new album, you're going to be fine. You know, in the early 70s, that was an eternity. And so the industry really, Atlantic Records started getting really impatient. And, you know, so it was considered a really long time at that particular juncture in music history. So that really hurt them and impacted them. But also their lives were different. You know, these were growing men. They weren't boys anymore. They weren't teenagers and young adults like they were when they were recording their first big albums in the 60s. You know, they had growing families, and the breakup changed them. You know, I think that there was some internal lack of confidence as well. I don't know that they knew how to work together in the same way that they used to. You know, I think they were contending with all those different things. So I think that made that period pretty complicated when they were trying to find their audience, trying to figure out their sound. And so they needed somebody to come in and help them, you know, sort of reset, which is what Arif did, you know, in 74 with Mr. Natural, and got them on a path. So that was really, really important, a very critical moment for them.
Yeah, even by 73 and the release of Life in a Tin Can, there were still lawyers' letters flying around. Robin's lawyer sent a letter to Barry talking about the imbalance of, you know, the writing credits and the distribution of the lead vocal on Tin Can, you know.
And how important do you think it was as well that Stigwood never gave up on them? Because, you know, some managers might be a bit more impatient, but he was really just completely devoted to them.
He'd invested a lot of money in them. And, you know, it's the music business, you know, and sort of, it doesn't just happen. So you need some return from your for your investment there. So yeah, let's say, and they were still making good returns, not specifically on record sales, but on the back of the tours. You know, so he was earning from successful tours, as I said previously, in the US, Australia, Japan, Far East. So yeah, like he needed to keep the faith. He needed to find a solution to the problem, and Arif was the obvious answer to that from his point of view.
Yeah, a lot of people. I feel that Arif Mardin has been given a little too much credit at points. I mean, it was a masterstroke to get him to produce them, right? I think it was such a good fit. And Stigwood had at least the foresight to recognize that, with, you know, thankfully for everybody. But, you know, a lot of people speak about that period and talk about the Bee Gees as though they were sort of these, you know, lost and disheveled, dilettantes that had no idea how to make a record. And Arif Mardin came in and, you know, all of a sudden made them into this successful group. And I think that's completely inaccurate. You know, the Bee Gees, that transition into more of an R&B soul-based sound, that had already been there. You know, you can't write a song like To Love Somebody or I Can't See Nobody and not have a little bit of soul, yeah. You know? So, and there were Black artists that were recording the Bee Gees early on. And so, you know, their adeptness in that area, I think, was pretty well recognized. But I think being able to put that in action and evolving to, you know, a mid-70s R&B sound. And, you know, at the time, especially in America, you know, as that was evolving, you know, you had more and more white groups who were, you know, sort of digging into that R&B influence and really making some impactful records, records that were not just making good headway on the mainstream charts, but also on Black music charts and things like that as well. There was a blurring, and you know, Black audiences were listening to white artists and really sort of embracing that. And so, you know, when they got to Miami, TK Records, was really influenced at the time, Casey and the Sunshine Band and the Hughes Corporation and other folks that were recording, you know, these sort of really exceptionally catchy and infectious R&B singles, you know, they got dropped into the middle of that. And so, you know, they got really inspired. But so Arif just brought out the ingredients. You know, he was sort of the executive chef. But they were always there. And so I think that his ability to give them the confidence to say, you can do this, you can sound like that, and it's okay, you know. And Arif was an expert at that. He'd worked with Aretha Franklin. He'd worked with Average White Band. He'd worked with Hall & Oates. And so he had a track record that really supported that. And so he did some really outstanding work. And if you listen to songs on Mr. Natural, think about Heavy Breathing, and you think about Lost in Your Love, and just the amount of conviction, you know, in those vocals and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, compared to what happened the year before, you know, with Life in a Tin Can and A Kick in the Head Is Worth Eight in the Pants. I mean, pretty stark contrast. So he worked some good magic with them. But that ability was always there, for sure. And that they had a complicated relationship with Robert Stigwood, you know, super beneficial in lots of different ways. You know, that would change a lot over the next few years and come to a head in the early 80s, obviously, with some problems. But the Bee Gees were Robert's Beatles. You know, he was as devoted to them as Brian Epstein and, you know, George Martin were to the other lads. And so, he didn't lose faith in them. And if it weren't for Robert Stigwood, they probably wouldn't have still had a label relationship with Atlantic. They probably wouldn't have been given a second shot. So it was really important.
And then Stigwood obviously also had a relationship with Eric Clapton, although he was known to be pretty jealous of the connection that, well, the attention he gave to the Bee Gees, I suppose. And like, we all know the story that it was him who encouraged them to go to Miami. And then he's spoken about it as well in the documentary a couple of years ago. But do you think that his role in things is possibly a bit overplayed, or is it kind of hard to say for definite?
I do. And I think we all agree on this a little bit. And so if you watch the documentary, Eric Clapton sort of seemed taken aback by the fact that this had happened. And so he's like, well, if I did that, it's the best thing I've ever done, you know? And so the thing was, Eric Clapton had went to record 461 Ocean Boulevard after years of, you know, being really deep in drug addiction, and he really struggled. And so at the time, Robert Stigwood and Bill Oakes, you know, the president of RSO, said, like, you've got to fix this and we've got to get you back on track. And so they sent Eric to Miami in, you know, 73, 74 to record 461 Ocean Boulevard. And so I believe that it was the same combination of folks who did that. And I think, but, you know, it's a cooler story to say that Eric Clapton, you know, who had made this major career recovery and had recorded this really successful album and came out of, you know, the depths of his depression and drug addiction to, you know, to glorious effect. I think it was probably a cooler story to say that he did it, you know. I think it was Robert Stigwood and Bill Oakes who pushed them in that direction. But, you know, the narrative changes. And, you know, we've learned that about BG stories over the years, that, you know, sometimes the narrative gets slightly twisted to sort of fit, you know, a certain perspective and things like that. And not in a devious way. I mean, I don't think it hurts anybody to say that Eric Clapton did that. I mean, you know, the BG still end up being the benefactors of that, you know, whole thing. But, you know, we came across a number of things, you know, so Main Course has, you know, is rife with stories, especially Jive Talking. You know, we talked about this on another podcast that we were on, you know, the other day, which, you know, we talk about the sound at the beginning of Jive Talking and where that all came from. And, you know, the story is that Barry was driving his Jeep between 461 Ocean Boulevard and Criteria in Miami. And he went over the Julia Tuttle Causeway, and that, you know, caused the chunking sound and, you know, it inspired him to think about the rhythm for Jive Talking. But, you know, Carl Richardson told me about a year ago that actually they might have been riding in a limousine from somewhere, and they went over a different stretch of street because, and I drove over the Julia Tuttle Causeway a few years ago because everyone's like, oh, you can still hear the sound. No, you cannot. It's a smooth patch of interstate. So you cannot hear the sound. And I drove her and I'm like, well, this is a bunch of crap. I mean, what?
our research goes deep, you know, like that if we retrace the steps, just to see whether it's true or not.
Research, firsthand research. But you know, and also, you know, the story about Jive Talking getting released on white record labels and sent to all the radio stations in America because, you know, people weren't going to play them if it had. And, you know, turns out the story really was is that they sent a few blank tapes to some radio stations and critics, you know, that, you know, the record stations actually got, you know, the real single with the Bee Gees name on it. And, you know, so, but I think, you know, and we talked about this previously, that those sort of pieces of reality get twisted a little bit, A, because I think everybody's memories are different. And I think Barry had that nice quote in the documentary that, you know, Frank Marshall made about, like, you know, there's no reality, just my memories. And I think that's true. You know, stories evolve over time. And if enough people validate them and they become true in your head, then they become the story, right? So I don't think anybody was trying to be purposely sort of devious. They were just, they had different memories, different things. And eventually over time, after 70 years, I'm sure those things all sort of coalesce. But also, sometimes it's just fun to have a cooler story about things. And so when you do press bits and things, you know, I think having a cooler story, but yeah, I was in my Jeep and I was, you know, the big chunk of the tires, you know, I got inspired and all of a sudden I got to the studio and we had this thing grooving, you know, does it really matter? Probably not. But it was fun to dig into some of that stuff and say, well, there's a few different perspectives. So I think that's, that was kind of fascinating to think about and whatnot. But yeah, so we don't know if the Clapton story is real, but at the end of the day, does it matter? Probably not. I mean, it's a nice little boost for Eric. It's a nice boost for the Bee Gees. So no harm, no foul.
Morris had, it was a good quote that we picked up from him. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. That's pretty much the way it is, you know?
Yeah. So obviously there were quite a few people who were really vital to how things turned around for the Bee Gees at this point. And you spoke to a few of them for the book. So I just wondered what that was like. Just what were some of the highlights of that, of getting to talk to these people and some of the insights that they were able to give you?
my research goes back a long, 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 long way. So we used quotes from a number of people that we'd interviewed for Tales of the Brothers Gibb. So these interviews predate 2000. And we spoke to a lot of people at that point. And obviously the insights that we were getting from Blue Weaver, for instance, were just absolutely phenomenal. And a couple of Andy Gibb's early band members, John Stringer and John Alderson, they gave us an immense amount of background on the early recordings that Andy made in Australia. But more recently, Grant has struck up relationships with Carl and Albie and Spencer, of course, and I'm sure he'll elaborate on the input that he got there. It's immense. It's just fantastic, the stuff that you gleaned from these guys, Grant.
Yeah, I cannot emphasize enough what geniuses, genii that Albie and Carl are. I mean, I'm in awe of them. And so I've loved these records for my entire life. And so the fact that I just wrote Albie one day and it's like, hey, you know, we're writing these books. Would you like to talk to me? He was like, absolutely. Let's sit down and talk. And Carl had the same reaction. And so, you know, I've sat online for hours and talked to Albie and Carl and listened to them banter back and forth. And, the science they used, absolute genius. I'm always in awe about what they did. The Bee Gees were so lucky to find them. I mean, they were certainly lucky to find the Bee Gees as well, but you know, I don't think half or three quarters of what happened to the Bee Gees in the late 70s and early 80s would have taken place if Albie and Carl hadn't been there to they didn't do everything, obviously. The Bee Gees had to have talent to make everything happen, but they certainly found ways to, they were so adept at taking what was happening in Barry, Robin, and Morris's heads and being able to make it a reality. And so Barry could hear records in his head, and this is exactly how I wanted to sound. And through whatever miracle of nature, Carl and Albie were able to go, yeah. And then immediately make it happen with the musicians, make it happen with the arrangements, with strings, with percussion, with all those different things. I mean, it was just this sort of really magical collaboration. And so, you know, they are hands down the reason why those records happened. But the detail to which they remember things, sometimes they don't remember titles of songs. And so they really had to sit down and listen to some of the records again and be like, oh yeah, this song, when we were talking about Spirits Having Flown a few years ago, you know, Albie started and said, you know, what was the name of the ballad that we worked on? The ballad, what was the name of the ballad? And I'm like, Too Much Heaven? And he's like, yeah, that one. Well, but they could remember, like, this is the width of the tape that we used, you know, in this recording. And this was the measurement of the section of tape I pasted in on Stop, Think Again. And we put it in between these two particular verses. And, you know, this is how many tracks we used for this song. This was the brand of synthesizer we used with this modulation. To the point where I just don't understand how they remember that stuff and employed it too. So especially work on Spirits Having Flown, which is scientifically an amazing album, as well as being sonically a really wonderful album as well. I mean, the experimentation, the innovation, just phenomenal. And they're willing to talk about all of it. And, you know, now they're living pretty quiet lives. Albie's on a boat right now in Greece, you know, so once he gets back, we're going to talk about the 1980s a little bit and, you know, see what we can dig up out of those conversations. But just, you know, they're responsible for some of the greatest records of music history. And by sitting down and talking to them, they are just lovely people who are just really proud of what they did and love that period in their lives. And they are so much more humble than they maybe should be for what they accomplished. So, you know, really, really great conversations. And I'm really thankful that I've struck up that kind of relationship with them where I can call them up and say, mind chatting with me about, you know, Guilty, let's talk about it. And, you know, so yeah, they've been very willing participants, thankfully.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite elements of the book, was reading all that detail, because I'm real nerdy about just recording techniques and how things were put together. So yeah, that's one of the things I liked a lot about it.
There's another couple of names we should mention, primarily with the 60s books. Obviously, Vince Maloney was critical to us there. Vince has been guesting with the Italian Bee Gees for a number of years now. And a few years ago, I did a week on the road with them. And it was one morning after breakfast. Vince and I sat down and I recorded the entire thing. We talked for about 5 hours. So you can imagine the kind of stuff I was getting out of him at that point, you know. And somebody else, let's say, whose name you probably won't relate to, Jane Stevens, Jimmy Stevens' daughter. Okay, sadly, Jimmy passed away while we were writing the 70s book. But I hooked up with Jane, and she brought all of Jimmy's photographs and a memoir that he'd started writing and tour itineraries and stuff like that. And the amount of information that we gleaned directly from his memoir and the tour itineraries is just absolutely phenomenal. It gave us all the detail of the 1973 UK tour, which was eventually cancelled. And also detail in there about they were supposed to be doing a Royal Command performance in the presence of Princess Anne at the Royal Festival Hall in London. Of the 73 tour, all the dates were cancelled apart from the London Palladium. And the day after was when this Royal Command performance was supposed to take place. It was a hell of a bill. John Denver was on there, and it was going to be headlined by Paul McCartney and Wings. Bee Gees were going to appear directly before them. The Bee Gees had a 15-minute slot. The set was already worked out, what they were going to be performing. It was going to be with a 20-piece orchestra conducted by Glyn Hale, who was the conductor on the 1973 tours, because the Bee Gees stopped working with Bill Shepherd in 1972. And this album, this Royal Command performance, it was cancelled. We've never figured out what the reason for it was, but it was going to be a huge production. It was going to be a worldwide broadcast, and they were even going to make a live album of it, which would have been absolutely amazing. Again, let's do with the album that they were talking about recording at the Royal Festival Hall when they performed 19th of February 1973. We needed a live album from the Bee Gees at that time to actually hear what they sounded like in concert with an orchestra. I know nowadays we have all the YouTube videos of, Festival Hall in Melbourne in 71 and 74. But up until that point, if you hadn't seen the Bee Gees in concert and you didn't live in Australia or Japan, lots of it with the Love Sound specials that they did in 72, 73 and 74, you didn't know what the Bee Gees actually sounded like live in concert. So a few missed opportunities there, unfortunately. But yeah, lots of enormous thanks to Jane for giving us access to these documents. It's really, really fascinating.
Thanks for listening to this part of the conversation. Stay tuned in a few days' time for part two, where I'll be continuing the conversation with Andrew and Grant, and we will get into the late 1970s and that word disco that followed the Bee Gees around, as well as Saturday Night Fever and the career of their younger brother, Andy. That's all to come, so stay tuned. Part two will be on your favourite podcast platform in a few days' time.